This is session 1711, Obamacare, repeal, replace, repair, or renege. One of the hallmarks of the CWA, of the Conference on World Affairs, is that we listen to all points of view with respect and accord others the right to express their opinions. As a moderator, I'll introduce the panelists, and they'll speak each for 8 to 10 minutes, and then we'll have 10 minutes for them to pose questions to one another, and then we'll have 30 minutes for questions from the audience, including those that are sent to me electronically. That'll take us to 4:20. There are two microphones, as I mentioned. Students have a preference, so if you're a student, regardless of your age, please feel free to come to the front of the line, and if you send me a question, indicate student on there. When you ask a question, especially if you're doing this orally, you can say, I'm a student, I'm a junior at CU, my major is X, here's my question. Questions usually start with words like why, how, what, not, let me tell you my life story. If you start to go down that road, I will hold up this sign. This is a caution sign. And that means you should pivot to a question. Why, what, how? If you don't, I'm going to hold up this sign. And that means you're going to sit down. And I have a hunch that the people in the audience will help you understand that rule. Linda and I moved here in 1989, and one of the things we discovered about Boulder was the Conference on World Affairs. It is one of the treasures of this community. We've been involved as supporters financially, but we're among the 600 volunteers who make this program possible. One of the longstanding phrases that is attributed to Conference on World Affairs is free and open to the public, and it is free in that you're welcome to come. Everybody is welcome to come. There's no charge to participate, but it's not without cost. And as John said, either getting involved as a volunteer, which is very rewarding, or as a supporter, a financial supporter, is also appreciated. I've worked for the past 45 years in healthcare administration and higher education in what we call academic medicine as an administrative leader and as a teacher, and for the last 18 years as a leadership coach for physician executives in medical schools. The issue of affordable and accessible health care for all people who live in the United States has been a central theme for me since I entered graduate school in 1970. In spite of the 45 years that have passed, and the trillions and trillions of dollars that have been spent under multiple administrations representing both parties, in good economic times and in bad, we still have not found a workable model for the organization, funding, and delivery of health care that is effective and sustainable. Our nation now commits more than $3 trillion a year annually, 20% of our gross domestic product, to healthcare and related services, more per capita than any country in the world except for Luxembourg. And our population is no healthier than many other developed countries in spite of this considerable expenditure. There are people of influence who have come to appreciate that it's complicated. Some have even said, who knew how complicated this could be? Well, I gotta tell you, I think our panelists know, and I've known, when I was in graduate school, Medicare and Medicaid was only 5 years old, and we were just getting underway. The Accountable Care Act, Affordable Care Act, some people call it Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act is 7 years old. Before Medicare and Medicaid, people who were aged and people who were without resources went to public hospitals and stood in line. There wasn't a good system, and most people appreciate the benefits of both Medicare and Medicaid. This is not about your political persuasion, nor it is about whom you voted for in the most recent election. It is, to some degree, about where you may fall along the spectrum of liberal to conservative, small government to big government, where your beliefs are as far as what the role is of government and what role it should play in organizing and appropriating the nation's resources, some would say reappropriating. These are your resources, of course. Appropriating them for the greater good. Many say government exists for the people, and do for the people what the people cannot reasonably do for themselves. Create rules and processes for decision making, protect our nation from others who would do us harm, build infrastructure, maintain a stable currency, enable utility services like a reliable electric grid, roads and bridges, clean water, safe communities, good schools. Healthcare falls within this envelope. So let's listen to our panelists and then talk about this issue as it is essential to all of us. I'm going to introduce the panelists in the order in which they're going to speak, which is from your right to left. And our first speaker, Dr. Reza Ramazani, and he's returning for the second year. He was on this panel last year. Reza is a professor and former chair of the Department of Economics at St. Michael's College in Vermont, where he's been teaching international and environmental economics since 1986. Ramazani's research has been in the areas of international trade, international finance, environmental economics, economic development, and primarily focusing on China. Our second speaker is Lloyd Sederer. He has written extensively on mental health and addictions. He's a medical editor for mental health at the Huffington Post, adjunct professor at Columbia at the Mailman School of Public Health, and chief medical officer for the New York State Office of Mental Health, the nation's largest state mental health agency. Stephen Hayward. Stephen is currently senior resident scholar at the Institute of Governmental Studies at the University of California, Berkeley, the other Boulder, and a visiting lecturer at the Bolt Hall Law School. He was previously the Ronald Reagan Distinguished Visiting Professor at Pepperdine University, their Graduate School of Public Policy, and was the inaugural visiting scholar in conservative thought and policy here at the University of Colorado in Boulder in 2013 and 14. And Dr. Joel Gallant,
is it Gallant?
Gallant, he's Gallant, is medical director of specialty services at Southwest Care Center in Santa Fe, New Mexico, where he provides patient care and conducts research on HIV and viral hepatitis. He also holds faculty appointments at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and the University of New Mexico School of Medicine. He's an internationally recognized expert on HIV infection. Reza?
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, David. As probably some of you know, I'm the product of this wonderful university. I got my PhD in economics department in 1986, so I want to tell you, if you don't like my presentation, you can blame the economics department for not training me well. And I think it's always nice to be back home. This is a wonderful university, and this is a wonderful place, so it's always a pleasure for me to come back home. I want to start with a point of clarification. I know for some people, especially some politicians, Obamacare is a cuss word. But I want to make sure that we are not confused or see there is a difference between Obamacare and Affordable Care Act. Believe it or not, they're exactly the same. If you hate Obamacare, then probably you're against American Affordable Care Act too. So I want to make sure those two are exactly the same. Unfortunately, some people in this country, they know that they don't know exactly the difference between those two. Now, what I want to start, I'd like to start with Obamacare, and to say Obamacare relies on three major pillars. And those are critical for any effective healthcare in this country. And I guess if we shaken those pillars, or if to get rid of even one of them, I think we are not going to have a type of insurance that we, I think, deserve as an American in this country. The first pillar of Obamacare is insurance companies are regulated. And I think that's the key, especially in this business. They're prevented from denying coverage or charging higher prices to American with a pre-existing condition. And I think that's the first condition, the first pillar of Obamacare or any effective healthcare in this country or any other country. The second one, families receive the subsidies that link to both their income and also the price of a premium they're going to pay. The third key pillar or important issue is there is penalty for young people, healthy people, that they think they don't need health care. Now, a lot of people question this, why, as a healthy person, I should be forced to participate. And if I decided not to participate in this program, why have to pay a penalty or a tax? The reason is insurance company, like any other company, are motivated by self-interest. And even if we are talking about the healthcare companies that is motivated is not to maximize their profit, they have to be able to at least, you know, to cover the cost of the operation. And the reason the third pillar is important because we want to reduce, we're concerned about the risk, because the insurance company cannot survive if they have to insure only old, poor, and sick people. And that's the reason we need to give incentive or induce young, healthy people to be part of this program. Now, at the same time, we have to be honest that Obamacare or ACA is facing some major problems. It's not perfect. And I think we have to be honest and identify at least three major challenges or the problems that Obamacare or ACA is facing today. The first one is a significant increase in the average premium, and the data back this argument, especially in 2017. The second challenge is today there are fewer health plan options or choices, at least in some of the states, not all the states, but some of the states. And the third challenging or problem with Obamacare is a lower than expected exchange enrollment and the risk pool stability challenges that some of the states are facing. So there are, again, on average, people who sign up for Obamacare have been much older, they are sicker and more expensive to care for than a lot of insurance company would expect. So the combination of higher premium, or I think if you look at all those three challenges, we see why in some of the states the premium is going up and why some of the insurance company are justifying the fact that they're leaving some of this estate because they're losing money. I think, and again, I have to be very careful, it's not happening all over the United States. Of some of the states that are experiencing these challenges, I think one is in Tennessee, I believe, another one is Oklahoma, another one is Arizona, but at this issue, I think the situation is much more different than other states like New York, like California, Wisconsin, by far they're doing well, and a lot of this insurance company, I think, in a good shape, and they are making some profits. So I think it's a mixed bag when we compare all these states in the United States. So I think it's fair when some Republican criticize these three aspects of the Obamacare, but unfortunately, the past 7 years, the Republican, or some politician, I should be fair, some politician, they use every playbook in their book, try to get rid of the Obamacare. And they were saying that Obamacare is going to collapse on its own weight. And they have been telling the same story to American public for the past 7 years. Now, I was a little bit puzzled when they came up with their own healthcare. One would expect that this is smart people with 7 years of time to come up with a plan that at least as good as Obamacare. But I want to tell you that what is really, I want to compare Obamacare, even with the three challenges that I mentioned, compare what we received from the new administration during the past, say, month or so. So they were very clever. They said they really do not want to get rid of those three pillars of Obamacare. They realize those three pillars are critical for any type of a healthcare. But unfortunately, they have shaken those pillars. And I want to give you evidence why I think it's shaken so badly, that their plan is not going to survive. And there is no comparison between what we have today with all the challenges with Obamacare. This is what we receive from the new administration. Now, what they have done, they said they wanted, said the insurance company is still barred from excluding the sick, but at the same time, they're allowing the insurance company charging older American by far a higher premium. And we know older American people like me are the one they're going to use more insurance than young people, healthy people. So that's a little bit disgenuine, dishonest, I think, as far as I'm concerned. Now, they said also with the subsidy, they still want to keep the subsidy. They said they're not going to get rid of the subsidy once for all, at all. But it's really not a subsidy, it's a tax credit. But however, it's no longer this tax credit is going to be tied to your income or to the cost of the insurance. So to me, I think it's a watered down version of the subsidy that we already received under Obamacare. Now, also they're going to tax, the right now under Obamacare, if I'm a healthy young person, I have to pay a penalty or I have to be taxed if I refuse healthcare. Now, that tax is going to disappear under new plan, and it's going to be a small surcharge. For example, if a young person, a healthy person, refuse to be a part of the healthcare, then there's going to be a surcharge. But the surcharge is not going to go to the public, it's going to the insurance company. Now, what is wrong? What is going to happen if we implement, you know, the new idea that more or less they're arguing that, look, the pillars are there, but they are not as strong as before. Now, the problem I see, and I think some economists already have done some study comparing the new plan, is this plan might be good for the wealthy young American. They're going to benefit from the new plan. But I think it's going to have a devastating effect on older American people like me. And AARP has already done the math. For example, a person who is 55 years old and his or her income is $25,000, their premium is going to increase by $3,600. The person who is 64 and is making $15,000, his or her premium is going to increase by $8,400. So I think I need to stop at this point because I think it's a good idea for me to stop. And I want to elaborate a little bit why this new plan is going to collapse out of its own weight. And not the after 7 years of spending a lot of time, a lot of money criticizing Obamacare, they came up with a plan and it's not even close to the Obamacare. And as I said, I don't think it's going to succeed. And as I'm sure all of you noticed, a lot of the Republicans themselves are not very happy with this plan. They thought it's very close to Obamacare, or really this is the job of a government is not to involve in the healthcare at all. Thank you.
Okay. Good afternoon. I work for state government, and for the past 10 years before that, I worked for New York City government, so my perspective is from that. Before that, I made a living in a legitimate way, took care of patients and ran services. But I think it's important to amplify some of the points that Reza made, because in fact, there's not just the Affordable Care Act, there's a complementary act which has a lot of bearing. So the Affordable Care Act had among its requirements 10 essential benefits which are apt to be stripped by a change, by repeal, and whatever gets replaced if that happens. And among those are preventative care in particular, which greater support for primary care practices. Most of the money in healthcare is spent for expensive hospital-based practices. 6 to 11 cents on a dollar is spent on primary care. And primary care is where we're all going to go, and that's where our best opportunity is for prevention, early detection, and treatment. So this is, and estimates are that the affordable, if you repeal the Affordable Care Act, about 20 to 25 million Americans will lose their health insurance, 20 to 25 million. So that's the first aspect of the law. The second law, which is a complementary law, among the essential benefits are also mental health and addiction benefits, which I want to come back to and exemplify. The second law, it was passed in 2008, but didn't really have any stringent regulations until a few years ago. It's called the parity law, which requires if you're an insurance company and you cover mental health at all, which you have to do now under the Affordable Care Act, you may not in the future, you have to provide benefits for mental health and addictions, no different from any other condition, heart disease, diabetes, Parkinson's, cancer, doesn't matter. You have to provide the same benefits in terms of total annual dollars, deductibles, copays, and you can't exclude that condition. So the Parity Act essentially added another 10 million or so Americans. So the estimates are if you put these two acts together and you void what we have now, about 32 million Americans will lose their coverage at a time where we have the largest opioid epidemic in this country. And I want to illustrate why that's important, not just because of humane considerations, which are significant, but in my state, New York, we have 19 million population, 19 million, 6.1 million New Yorkers are on Medicaid, the insurance for the poor, 6.1 million. And the other thing that is apt to happen is that the financing of Medicaid, which is essentially a federal share, state spends a nickel, the Fed spends a nickel, it's a matching, that financing is going to be changed. Because it's independent of the Affordable Care Act and its regulations in HHS. The estimates are from my government's budget office is that that will immediately result in a $4 billion reduction to New York State for Medicaid, $4 billion a year to begin with, and then it erodes after that. And why that's important is, and I've been part of doing the analyses in New York, when we look at the 5% of Medicaid recipients who expend 50% of the total Medicaid dollar, these are called high utilizers, high flyers, these are the most ill and greatest users of healthcare services. When we analyze that, 80% of these individuals whose expenditures are for medical surgical care, emergency room, hospital, 80% of them have an active mental health or substance abuse condition, which is why my agency has standing in New York, because if you're going to try to reduce unnecessary expenditures, you have to detect and treat mental health and substance abuse problems, because nobody with a chronic condition can care for it. The person with diabetes, if they're depressed, if they're using too much alcohol, if they're using prescription drugs, they just will not manage their health condition, and they will continue to be the most expensive users of health care. So there's an important economic driver here that states are about to be stripped of their capacity to cover Medicaid recipients and Medicare as well. But and the costs of this are not just in terms of human suffering. They are going to essentially prevent some of the cost controls that we've seen, we've been able to achieve in New York, because we've built in behavioral health, mental health into primary care. So Affordable Care Act, Parity Act, and Medicaid in particular, and Medicaid expansion, which is also on the chopping block, which is in 31 states and D.C., which enabled another 12 million people to receive Medicaid benefits, a million in New York. These are the three turbulent volcanoes that are either erupting or about to erupt, and the consequences will be that a great many people will not have health insurance, and many people will go untreated for a whole host of chronic conditions, including mental health and substance abuse, and the price will be not just humane, it will be economic.
Well, I'm not a healthcare policy wonk. I have a lot of friends who are, and they're mostly miserable and glum people, it seems, much of the time. I was looking this up the other day, 25 years ago, I wrote a long magazine feature article about Medicare. It took me a long time to do it. I learned a lot. It was very sobering. And that's one reason I haven't gone back to that. For my sins, I've done energy instead, which is almost as big an abyss in policy terms. So I have a simple, but I hope not simplistic idea, although there are lots of difficulties with it, which I'll come to. I have a radical idea that we ought to tear the whole thing out and start over again from the ground up. And I'm not sure that can be done, and I'll tell you why. One reason why might be the simple analogy of the typewriter keyboard. We're all used to the QWERTY keyboard that apparently evolved by chance 150 years ago, whatever. And every once in a while you hear somebody say, you know, that's an irrational keyboard. If it did it this way, it'd be much better. And maybe that's correct, but of course we're not. We're path dependent, as the cliche goes, right? And I type very fast, and I wouldn't want to learn a new darn keyboard. And healthcare may be a little like that, unfortunately. But I thought I would try to do is, many of you probably know the sort of synoptic history of how what I call the original sin of American healthcare policy began. I'd like to start it this way. I found on the internet, which means it must be true, of course, a hospital bill from for a childbirth at a hospital in McKeesport, Pennsylvania from 1943. And it's just one page, and it's got a little itemization, room and board, delivery room, doctor, anesthetic, laboratory exam, drugs, $29.50. Now, 2 points. One is, that was not a trivial sum then. That could have been a week's take-home pay for a factory worker in the war. And second, of course, they didn't have ultrasounds and, you know, all the modern technology that costs a lot of money to design, build, buy, operate, maintain, so forth. So, of course, not to mention antibiotics and all the... What antibiotics did we have back then? We had penicillin and, you know, aspirin. That's kind of about it. And morphine for pain, right? So, of course, that part of the world has changed. But that is the period what I call the original sin of American healthcare policy. A lot of you may have known this. You know, during the war, we had wage and price controls and a labor shortage. How do you compete for workers? The standard version is Henry Kaiser, but it wasn't just him, said, I know, we can offer health insurance to employees if they sign up to work for us. It was really cheap then, right? Because, you know, medical care was relatively cheap. But then, they didn't stop there. They actually had to do this. They lobbied Congress to make it a tax-free fringe benefit, because otherwise it would count as a wage. It would be taxable. Okay, fine. Except that it began us down the road of having a third-party payment. And I think also the private sector, two problems. We tended to over-insure. I'll say more about that in a moment. And it also has created, especially more expensive it got, it created a lot of job lock-in, right? You know, especially if you're a unionized worker with a really good healthcare plan that the union's negotiated. Hard to leave for another job, especially if you have a pre-existing condition, but even if you don't, right? So all kinds of defects arose right away. But then the overinsurance part of it, and then we just added on barnacle after barnacle ever since then, including the public programs, Medicare and Medicaid. And So, I mean, one problem here is, take a while to explain, but in summary, I'll try and do the example of auto insurance. We tend to overinsure if you're insured through your employer, because it's great tax-free fringe benefit, right? Suppose we did our auto insurance the way we do our health insurance, and you included in your auto insurance every oil change, every tank of gas you buy, all the tires you replace, your window wipers, right? Car washes, right? We do a lot of first dollar coverage in our health insurance for people who have it. And what would your auto insurance cost if we did it that way? And what would your price sensitivity be? I mean, one of the bizarre things these days is going to a hospital trying to ask for a price list for what things cost. Good luck getting a price list. Depends on what your insurance plan is and all kinds of other things. The accounting for hospitals has to be truly bizarre. I'll bet it makes Pentagon accounting look transparent. And so I think there's, people can contest what this means, and the suggestion of this factoid is right, is that you really see healthcare inflation begin to double the rate of underlying inflation, starting with the expansion of Medicare and Medicaid, and third-party payments. And now, the solution, I won't say I have no idea, but it seems to me that if we could go back and revisit that original sin, and start from scratch, we're bound to come up with something better. It might even be, I'll be really crazy here for a conservative, it might even be a single-payer program of some fashion. And you've heard Trump talk about that, right? Now, I say that there's path dependence like the typewriter keyboard. I'm not sure legally that's possible. I'm not sure. If you could do it, you'd have to have huge transition rules that would take several years for people like United Auto Workers who have, and retirees who have, you know, vested pension and healthcare benefits that they negotiated and paid for years ago as part of their union contracts. And how you handle that would be very difficult. The other problem, of course, is, am I out of my mind that you can start from scratch with today's politically dysfunctional world? And the answer is probably yes. On the other hand, and then I'll end with this, you know, it's not impossible to think of this. You know, we did do something I did study and written about a lot. The tax reform of 1986 was a bipartisan measure that involved, it's a great story, the lobbyists all thought they'd won and killed this. And the senators went home on a Friday afternoon and said, we're beaten, it's finished, it's done, like the health care bill. And then they all snuck back on Saturday morning, Republicans and Democrats, and wrote the bill and voted on it first thing Monday morning to get it out of the Senate and took all the lobbyists by surprise and screwed them all. It was a wonderful moment. You know, Pat, I mentioned Pat Moynihan this morning. He said it was the most splendid, unsorted moment he'd seen in the Senate's history. That's not that long ago. And then welfare reform in 1996, you know, that had 100 Democratic votes. Bill Clinton signed it, right? That was a complete sweeping change, but it was pretty big. It was a really, really big change. So even in our recent history, we've seen that now and then it's possible for, I almost hesitate to use these words because they sound so ridiculous, for the two parties to come together and actually do something that's not completely evil and stupid, like you know that joke of the evil and stupid party.
Well, I was anticipating having a lot more disagreements with my conservative colleague than I do, but I like that idea. So let me just tell you who I am. I'm an HIV doctor. I take care of a lot of underserved people. Our clinic is very much dependent on many of the features of Obamacare, including Obamacare itself, the exchange, Medicaid expansion, as well as some other programs that are also threatened under the current administration. And I do believe that government has a role to ensure that its citizens have health care. It doesn't mean they have to provide the health care, but they need to make sure that everyone has it. I was a supporter of Obamacare, though it was never the perfect solution. I was very sad when we lost that government option that I viewed as sort of a stepping stone toward a single-payer plan, but of course that was exactly why they got rid of it. Before Obamacare, our so-called health system was a complete disaster. It was the most expensive in the world, denying care to millions of people with poorer outcomes compared to cheaper, more universal systems. And we still have the most expensive healthcare in the world, and we still have comparatively poor health outcomes. But Obamacare has done one thing. It has expanded coverage. There was a doomsday cult that predicted that the world was going to come to an end, or at least our country was, with Obamacare. That didn't happen. Republicans made countless attempts to repeal it because they knew that they couldn't. And now that they can, of course, they're getting cold feet because the idea of taking health care away from 20 million Americans is scary even to the coldest Republican heart. So, but what I'm finding is that the propaganda machine keeps churning just like it did when Obama was president. And even my own kind of lefty colleagues are starting to, you know, drink some of the Kool-Aid because it's all you hear. And I want to go through some of the objections to Obamacare that were out when it was being proposed and are still out there and kind of pick them apart because some of them aren't really very true. First of all, it was said it wouldn't work. Well, the number of uninsured people fell to the lowest on record, from 20% down to 8%. And in the states that expanded Medicaid, the uninsured declined by 40%. If you look at Medicaid expansion in a red state, Kentucky, they've seen a drop in breast cancer deaths, infant mortality, hospital admissions, et cetera. It was said it would raise health care costs. In fact, Pete Sessions, the chairman of the House Rules Committee, said it would raise the coverage expansion would cost $5 million per person. Well, it was actually $4,000. But it was lower than had been predicted, even by the Congressional Budget Office. Health care prices since Obamacare have risen, but they've risen at their slowest rate in 50 years, and actually declined for Medicaid and Medicare. Growth in deductibles have been the same as they were for before Obamacare, and employer costs have also declined. Premiums have gone up, but they were going up before Obamacare. And in fact, the states with the largest premium increases have not seen a decline in enrollment because of the fact that a lot of the people are protected from those increases by tax credits. Yes, if you've got a more comprehensive plan, it's going to cost you more than an old plan you might have had before that didn't cover much, and it's certainly higher than not having any insurance at all. But, you know, that hasn't all been due to Obamacare. It was said it was going to be a job killer. In fact, in 2011, the House passed the Repealing the Job-Killing Health Care Law Act. Great name. But in fact, the private sector added over 16 million jobs since Obamacare, almost all in full-time employment. It was said that it would decrease the quality of care. Well, in fact, if you look at Medicaid expansion states and compare them with non-expansion states, quality of care indicators are much higher in those that expanded Medicaid, and that gap continues to increase, suggesting that it really is due to to Obamacare, not just a trend that was already being seen. And in fact, in Massachusetts, mortality declined after Romney Care was instituted. We've also seen decreased in hospital-acquired conditions and readmission rates in places in hospitals. It was said that it was a government takeover of healthcare, and people threw around the term socialized medicine. Well, government funding of healthcare is only socialist until you're 65, or if you're a vet, or if you're in the military, and then suddenly it becomes an untouchable right. But in fact, those are probably the three most popular forms of health care for the people who receive them in the United States: Medicare, VA, and military medicine. When John McCain got his melanoma, did he go to a fancy private hospital in Phoenix? No, we went to the Army Hospital in Washington, and we knew he was going to get good care there. It was said people would have to change insurance. Well, duh, they were having to do that before Obamacare. People were getting thrown off the insurance rolls all the time. Insurance companies made money by getting rid of sick people. And many of the people who had to change were changing from plans that had a lot of restrictions or lifetime limits on coverage. It was said it would narrow networks and reduce your choice. Again, also was happening before Obamacare. This law is covering people who weren't insured before. They had no choice at all except to go to an emergency room, which we paid for. So, and then most importantly, it was said it was going to be unpopular. And recent surveys have shown that it's more popular than ever. In fact, its popularity is now over 50%, especially if you call it the Affordable Care Act, not Obamacare. When you call it Obamacare, the popularity goes down a little before 50%. But, you know, there are a lot of believers, and one of the problems when Obamacare was being proposed was that the press was not about what it covered or the details. It was all about the politics of it. People learned about the politics, but they didn't know. So more people still in America believe that Obamacare includes death panels than they do knowing that the costs come in under projection. This is a media issue. It's not an inherent fault of Obamacare. So let's talk about repeal. We've talked about the weaknesses of the American Health Care Act, and I want to go a little further and say it's the worst piece of legislation in my memory. It's basically a hastily cobbled together tax cut for wealthy disguised as health care reform. And it reminds me of like the paper that the stoner dude in college did the night before it was due, and there's a coffee stain on it. I mean, they had 7 years, and that was the best they could come up with. The number of uninsured would increase up to 24 million, bringing us back to 20% uninsured. Premiums would go up. It was estimated there'll be a $1.2 million reduction in benefits. And it provides $860 billion in tax cuts, over $350 million to high-income people, and the rest to health insurers and drug corporations. Get this, the top 400 households would get tax cuts worth more than the tax credits for 800,000 people. So this was just amazing. And, you know, I know that Trump wants to do tax reform, but let's not do it in disguise. Let's call it what it is. So what about this death spiral? Well, Trump said the best thing is to let Obamacare explode so he can make one beautiful deal for the people. Well, the death spiral doesn't happen on its own. Death spirals occur when the pool of people insured by a plan are especially unhealthy, use more than the expected amount, and then the insurance company raises the premium, the healthy people drop out more, and it's so on and so on. So it's negatively reinforcing. The thing is, that doesn't happen with Obamacare because 85% of people don't pay the increase in premium. It's covered by subsidies. So who pays? The taxpayers. The government pays those increasing costs. So you can't really have a spiral unless you induce it on purpose. You know, throughout Obama's presidency, Republicans were making rules that would make enrollment harder. They were decreasing advertising, cutting budgets. Mitch McConnell called brochures on how to enroll propaganda. So if Trump tells the IRS not to enforce the penalty on those who opt out, it could reduce the number of participants. It won't cause a death spiral, but it'll increase costs. He could abandon other subsidies that are built into the program but not funded, which again could force some insurers out of the market. There are waivers built into the system where states that have really good ideas on how to achieve the same outcomes can do it and get exempt from Obamacare regulations. What Trump looks like he's doing now is letting states that do a really bad job get waivers. So rather than learning from the successful states, we're going to just make the bar really low. And of course, even under the best of circumstances, if we leave things alone, no one in the current administration is going to try to fix the flaws in Obamacare. That's pretty much a given. So what could happen? Well, one is we just continue the status quo without making any improvements, but without really changing anything. And if that happens, Obamacare will continue. It's not going to explode on its own. There's a Republican option. Basically, if you don't have insurance, that's your problem. The issue there is that Medicaid is hard to touch, okay? I mean, yes, you can switch to block grants, but you're not going to undo Medicaid. So ironically, what's more at risk in the current administration is private insurance, because it's easier to screw up. So, and kind of ironically, conservatives could actually undo benefits in private coverage, setting the stage for a single-payer system such as Medicare for All, which could happen in a kind of as an indirect result of what's going on now with the Trump administration. Trump initially favored universal coverage. It was what he proposed was far more universal than Obamacare. But of course, he changed his mind after the election and gave it to Price and Ryan to do with what they wanted. Interestingly, Price was being investigated by Preet Bharara before Trump fired him, and he was being investigated for benefiting from drug company stocks affected by policies that he was pushing. So I kind of I agree that our medical health care system, be great to tear it down. I'm not optimistic that that can happen, mainly because I think the insurance company lobby is way too powerful. But I do think that a separate parallel government option, which would by definition have much lower administrative costs than private insurers do, could help us to get there. And I think ultimately that's what we're going to need to do if we're going to have a system that is reasonably priced and that covers everyone. Thank you. Thank you.
we're going to have a little conversation. I'm going to pose a question to the panel, and I've got about 20 questions that have come in electronically. People who don't have that facility can go to the microphones. Let me pose a question. First, I'm reminded that Winston Churchill said of Americans that they will always do the right thing after they try everything else. And we call this a healthcare system, and people in the field know it's neither a system nor is it focused on health, but rather illness. And Americans, and I'm generalizing, I know that's not, this is not the case for the people in the room, generally, many of the illnesses, not all by any means, are self-imposed, lack of nutrition, exercise, other risky behaviors, other self-imposed factors. Is it possible we could pivot to a healthcare system where, and some of the Affordable Care Act does focus on preventive health issues, preventive medicine issues. What is the opportunity as we go forward to ACA 2.0?
So to a British economist said that Americans have a tendency to confound health care with health. And some of the best analyses indicate that our health, about 10%, maybe 15% of our health is determined by our health care. The rest, 80% and greater, by what are called the social determinants of health. And they tend to be our behaviors, how we lead our lives, our environments, where we lead our lives, the air we breathe, the water that we drink, and finally by our genetics. And the curious thing about our genetics is that there's now a total appreciation that our genes are turned on and off throughout our lifetimes on the basis of how we behave. So this is called the field of epigenetics. So DNA is not destiny. So if we're going to reshape the health of a country, it's going to be by our behaviors in terms of smoking, drinking, exercise, nutrition, a variety of mind-body activities that quiet the stress and inflammation in our body, by having safe communities, reliable housing, reducing domestic violence, and by taking care of ourselves so that we turn on the right genes and keep the wrong genes from producing cancer and chronic disease. So some countries, Scandinavian countries in particular, do put more of an accent on this. But in this country, we're still driven by thinking that the solution is better health care. And I don't think that the data support that.
You know, one of the big weaknesses in Obamacare that I will readily acknowledge is that there was the opportunity to do something about the way we reimburse for healthcare, and that it wasn't taken. And this is this kind of battle between what we often call cognitive specialties and procedural specialties. So the idea that a person who puts a stent in your coronary artery, you know, gets vastly more money for his time than a primary care provider does, or a pediatrician, or a family practice person. Now, of course, they deserve some more money because of the increased training they have, but the gap in reimbursement is way in excess of what it should be. And unfortunately, in our system, it rewards people for doing something to you, but does not reward them for taking care of you. And in an era where a typical medical student can graduate with a debt that's, you know, $150,000, it's really hard for them to justify going into a cognitive specialty because they'll be burdened with this mortgage-like debt for many, many years. And so, you know, and of course, that means that fewer doctors are going into primary care. And in addition, with Medicare, if you have a tummy ache, you can go to a gastroenterologist. You can skip the primary care and go to a gastroenterologist who's likely to put a scope in both your ends. So, those are the things that we haven't solved. And those are things that could bring down the costs of care is by having more of a kind of an emphasis on primary care physicians or practitioners as gatekeepers who look at the whole picture and then decide about specialty referral the way they do in most of the world. And I think we missed an opportunity to get that in when we did Obamacare.
As a traditional economist, I have a little bit problem, you know, with this notion that the government is a salvation and government is a solution for all of the challenges we're facing, including the healthcare. I have no problem with the statement that healthcare is human right, and I think it's every one of us has a right to the healthcare. But I'm glad some of the panelists mentioned, how about the individual behavior? How about the individual sense of responsibility? I agree with the gene, and I agree in some cases, you know, because a lot of people, even the poor people, low-income people, I think are smart enough. They know that it's good for them and good for their children when they have access to healthy food, fresh fruit and vegetables. But unfortunately, some of these people live in inner city and there is no transportation, there is no store that can deliver that kind of a product to those individuals. And also, the level of income is so low that they cannot afford. I live in Vermont, you know, I go to farmers market every Saturday. God bless those farmers, you know, and I totally believe you gotta buy fresh, gotta buy local, but at the same time, you have to be able to afford those products. I teach environmental economics. When I go to the farmer's market, I see the Vermont farmer putting three pieces or four pieces of kale together, and they're charging $7. Not to criticize them, to question them, I ask them, but how did you determine that you're supposed to charge $4? Why not $10 or $2? But really, they don't look at, you know, the cost of the product that's producing. So I think, you know, I don't want to blame only the individual that really they don't care about their own health. But sometimes, honest to God, as a government, you know, we don't provide them with the education or with the tools in order to take care of themselves. And I think in the long run, that's the most cost-effective way to reduce the cost of the healthcare in this country, by educating people and providing with the tools that take care of themselves before they get sick.
There are some principles about insurance that are really quite well understood, studied, and understood. Large numbers of people sharing risk over long periods of time, paying in a moderated premium, including when they don't need the service, when they don't draw out, such that they can draw out when they do. And one of the problems with healthcare is it's very fragmented. You can get in and out of the market. You used to be able to get in and out of the market without adverse consequence. One of the principles of the Affordable Care Act was that you had to participate in the market. Remember, there was a penalty. So to the panel, how come we don't have any part of our conversation at the government level that addresses the principles of insurance? They're kind of like the principles of gravity.
Well, I think we did address that during the whole debate. I mean, the whole idea was you had to have insurance. Now, you could argue that the penalty you paid for not having insurance for a young, healthy person might be a cost you're willing to bear, in which case we probably should have had a bigger penalty. But we definitely had that discussion. Unfortunately, now it's a cornerstone of making this work, as you point out, and yet Trump has told the IRS not to enforce it. In an effort to induce this death spiral that we keep talking about. So I think absolutely we're talking about this, and I completely agree with you. It's a cornerstone of making the whole system work.
Yeah, so it's a small point, but and sort of an arcane point of the first Obamacare Supreme Court case is that the tax penalty, as it became after some jiggery-pokery, wonderful legal phrase, if it was too small, right? But if it goes up too high, the court said you could revisit that for reasons I sort of forget now. But yeah, for a lot of younger people, you're better off paying a tax penalty than buying an insurance policy. But that brings you back to the basic question you posed about the basic principles of insurance. You know, I think, isn't it right, it begins with shipping 500 years ago, and you're insuring against catastrophe, right? A high cost but lower probability event. And that's not how we do healthcare, right? We, your standard health insurance policy through your employer is pretty much first dollar coverage for every doctor checkup you get. So there are difficulties with this because the mental health angle is an important one. But what if we went back to the idea of why don't you get everybody, especially young people, what they really most need, most of them, is catastrophic coverage, which is could be pretty cheap if you don't have all the mandates of all the other things you have to cover, although that raises lots of problems. But then, of course, what about people who either don't have insurance because they're not employed or whatever, and how do they... I see these figures that show that something like 40% of America's households don't have $500 in the bank to pay for an emergency expense. I mean, they make the paycheck to paycheck, right? So how do they handle those non-insured costs of a regular doctor visit, right? And that's a problem to solve. Maybe that problem is solved like we do what we used to call food stamps, but now an EBT card, right? I don't know. I don't know how any of that pencils out.
Well, the problem with having only catastrophic coverage is that the lack of primary care leads to catastrophic events. You reduce catastrophic events with primary care and preventive care. And so if you wait till somebody is really sick, you have a system kind of like what we have with uninsured people, is they wait till they're really sick, then they go to the emergency room, which has to take care of them at great expense to taxpayers, and all of that was preventable or could have been dealt with much smaller expenses if they had come in early. So that's I'm kind of afraid that providing only catastrophic health care is going back to our system of having, 40 million people uninsured and using the emergency room for catastrophic health care.
So three students have asked a similar question. I'll read one of them. Is it possible to make healthcare a less politicized issue and such that it would make it easier to create and establish a good healthcare system? In other words, how do we stop making this a politicized issue?
I'm not sanguine about that because what we've witnessed is how effective demonizing Obamacare is, how effective demonizing Muslims is, how effective demonizing Mexicans is, how effective demonizing the poor is, gets you elected to be president of the United States. Right? It gets you a fully controlled Republican Senate and Congress. So these are effective, we may not like them, but they are highly effective strategies. They're political strategies. They're essentially power strategies that work. And they work especially with people who are desperate. Those people who are in, who voted to bring in the administration. And these are good people, but they're poor. They're hopeless about their future. They're hopeless about their children's future. They have a lot of chronic conditions. Addiction, and they're angry. They've been left behind. They're angry. They're really very susceptible, vulnerable to demonizing strategies, which we've witnessed in an extraordinary way. So I'm not at all saying.
Well, I guess a dissenting view. There's no way you depoliticize something when you're going to try and solve it on the national level. Everything you centralize in Washington is going to get very political. Now, there have been some experiments in healthcare at the state level. I mean, there was Romney Care in Massachusetts. Oregon tried 15 years ago to move to some universal care that involved quite explicitly rationing. So good for them for being explicit about the trade-off. And I'm not sure how that's played out. I haven't looked at it for a long time. Utah had some interesting little experiments. This is not a big sweeping, not a grand fix, but I think it would not be a bad idea to allow some states to experiment with it again. And maybe one thing the federal government could do, and this came up in some of the Obamacare debate, the idea was thrown out, is why not allow cross-state insurance purposes? And that has certain benefits about making the states compete a little bit to not have as many mandates to make their insurance as high. I'm skeptical that would actually have much of an effect. But I think it might be worth something we should try. So, look, any issue, healthcare pay, once we're going to try and solve it in Washington, it's going to be deeply political, and good luck with that.
I might be very unrealistic, but as someone grew up in a different society and made many sacrifices the past 40 years to stay in this country and become a productive member of this society, I'm so saddened and disappointed what is happening in this country. And a lot of my colleagues in Vermont, they tell me, you're very unfair. You have much higher expectation about American and American people. And I totally agree with them. I made a lot of sacrifices to make a decision to stay in this country. Of course, I have a higher expectation, and I'm expecting more from this country and American people than the current regime in Iran. If I want to go to the same kind of difficulties and disappointment, I'd rather to be with my own people in Iran. Now, I think we, as we know, we are dealing with a dysfunctional government, and I think they are not willing to listen to facts, to data, to common sense, and the only thing they are doing is criticizing one another, and like a mad dog, barking at each other. Now, I am not, you know, everybody in this country, regardless of their background or their knowledge or their lack of knowledge or expertise, have a right to run for a high office. But what is saddening me when American people, educated people, vote for those people. So my solution might be very naive and unrealistic, but I think it starts with us as an American. We gotta be open-minded people. When politician making a statement, it sounds too good to be true, we should not wrap ourselves around the flag and follow them. Politicians act like a Santa Claus in this country. They go around and they ask you, what would you like to me? What would you like me to do? I'll be happy to do it. I think my job as a college professor to educate my student and say, look, you gotta listen to those people. If they come up with a good idea, you have to ask them, how are you going to do it? How much is it going to cost? And I think that's one of the things we can do to put the pressure on a politician. Say, look, this is something that is the right for all the Americans. We demand and we expecting you folks put your big ego aside and work for us. It's not about you. It's not about being Republican, Democrat, or progressive. It's about us as an American people.
I think in a country where evolution is political, it's impossible to think that healthcare will not remain political. But I have to say, it's not universal. And I was speaking in Australia and New Zealand and was visiting both government and private hospitals because they have a parallel system. They both seem nice. I couldn't tell the difference unless they told me. And over dinner, I talked to my colleagues there and I said, You presumably have conservatives and liberals in your country, right? And they said, yeah. And I said, do any of the conservatives feel that you should do away with the government system and have only a private system? And they looked at me with horror. They said, that is not a political issue. We all support this system. So we're in an unusual place where the idea of universal health care is political. How we got there, I'm always tempted to blame the insurance lobby whenever I can, so I'll blame them.
There are those who say that if politicians had to use the same program that the American people used instead of a preferred high-end program, that we'd have a much better healthcare program. A question from a student. As I primarily rely on the Veterans Administration for my healthcare, thank you for your service, what kind of changes do you see possibly happening within the VA military healthcare in future reforms, specifically in access and cost? And you may know that there's something called TRICARE, which is a government program for military and then the VA system, which has had a bit of scandal with respect to access, waiting times, and such. So anyone familiar with VA and...
Well, I've worked in a number of VAs, and you know, the scandal with the VA was not really quality of care, it was access to care. Quality of care is generally quite good at most VAs, and many of them are linked to academic teaching hospitals, so they're really serving as a part of that teaching hospital. They have fantastic physicians. And VA medical care is really quite popular once you get into the system. It was getting into the system that was hard. My concern, of course, with the current administration, everything is unpredictable. We could say, oh, don't worry, this line of funding is safe, but we could be wrong tomorrow morning when we pick up our phones and read the latest headline. At the same time, there have been pushes, and I worry that the access problem is maybe a slippery slope, that in order to fix the access program, we're going to privatize the VA. We're going to let people go out into the community. That sounds good on the surface, so that's a good immediate response to privatization. But is it really just kind of a way of undermining this sort of form of socialized medicine that we tolerate and love within our society? Because once you let people go out into the public sector, then you can kind of close the doors behind them. So I would rather that we fix the VA rather than trying to undo that system.
Just an additional comment about going into the private sector. One of the biggest problems healthcare faces is workforce. How many of you have tried to get a primary care doctor? It's really hard. How many of you have found it's really hard to get a primary care doctor? Right? My health insurance was changed by my employer, the state. I tried to find a primary care doctor. I couldn't find a primary care doctor, and I'm a doctor. So this idea that you can just simply privatize, as if the capacity of the existing system was anywhere near what it's needed, particularly with primary care doctors, pediatricians, psychiatrists, it's just not there. Nurses, physician assistants, we have a profound workforce healthcare problem. So it's a fantasy to just say, well, we'll just shift it from one place to another where the other doesn't have the capability. The second comment to the student who brought this up is that today's soldiers tend to be principally not active recruits. They're guard and reserve. More than half of the people who fight abroad are guard and reserve. And the benefits that they've had over time with the VA system were really quite limited. They were time limited. This has been stretched a bit. So the VA is, I think you're right, it is about increasing the capability, access, and some of the quality. It's uneven. There are some fantastic VAs, but also then how do you serve every veteran in perpetuity rather than have veterans come back and lose their VA coverage in 2 years or 4 years?
The next question, there's been much talk over the last few years about allowing those under 65 to buy into Medicare, which would be similar to single payer universal coverage. I'd like to see, the questioner goes on, I'd like to see the cost to fully cover this option on an individual basis. That's beyond the scope of the panel. But any comments on essentially opening up Medicare and allowing people to buy in? And also, you might speak to adverse selection in that process.
Well, yeah, I'd like to point out that administrative costs for Medicare are much, much lower than for private care, private insurance. And if you think about it, if you're running a practice or a clinic, and you're billing people who have to have different forms, know different regulations, different rules for 12 different insurance companies, including plus Medicare and Medicaid, is very, very complicated. This is why administrative costs for Canadian healthcare are so low, because they only have to bill one entity. Here we have to bill dozens sometimes. So one of the concerns with the government option during the early days of the Obamacare debate, before it got thrown under the bus, was that private payers wouldn't be able to compete with a government option, and that therefore they would lose out. And of course that was what we were all hoping, but it was why it was a non-starter. It wasn't going to happen, because no one's going to let it happen. I would love to see Medicare just brought down earlier and earlier and earlier until you just start out with it. But that would be maybe the way to let this happen sort of subtly, because everybody, when you say Medicare, they smile, you know, they like it.
Yeah, so We hear this a lot about Medicare's administrative costs are cheaper than private insurance. True. On the other hand, the Obama, so what's Medicare cost now? It's about $600 billion somewhere in that neighborhood. I think it was a year or two ago, the Obama administration's estimate of fraud and improper payments in Medicare, $60 billion. That's a lot of real money. It's easy to have low administrative costs if we do a crap job of not preventing fraud and improper payments. There's a broader point to that. I don't necessarily have an opinion about the buy-in early to Medicare. I my self-interest is I kind of like it because I might like to retire early, and one of the things deterring me is the gap in having to buy my own health care, which I've done a couple times lately through COBRA, and it's been very sobering. The problem with Medicare is, this is what I found out doing my research. The first year it cost $3 billion, 1966. That was back when the total federal budget was under $100 billion. So that was real money, but not off the chart. And you had a big wage base to pay the, 4% combined employer-employee tax rate. The projection then was that by 1990, I think that was as far as they could look, was it would cost $12 billion. 1990, it cost $109 billion. So they kind of missed on inflation and where healthcare costs would go. Now, you look out in the future, and, boy, the economists on this, I think, are very sobering. Social Security has got some problems, and it can be fixed with a few simple things. The unfunded liability of Medicare under the existing scheme, never mind lowering it down, is somewhere around $72 trillion now, I think. The tax rate's way too low. Unlike Social Security, which is kind of in balance, the Medicare tax rate is way too low. But I wonder if, right now you pay about 15% for Social Security. The business that the employer pays half is a fiction, really. And the Medicare rate, which some people are going to collect more on than Social Security, is, 5.9% combined, but with no income cap. We lifted that off under George H.W. Bush. That would have to triple, at least, to bring it back into balance. How many workers are going to pay 30% payroll taxes for Medicare and Social Security? The cost containment problem of these programs has been a disaster. I'm talking about the comparisons with other countries, Norway I know a little bit about, Canada. America's a different kind of place because we're much more heterogeneous. We have a much larger population that without, the means to do even part of their own healthcare expenses, which is not true, say, of Norway. We could go on a long time about those comparisons, but, it's pretty bleak when you look at the big numbers.
Let's not forget, if you increase the Medicare withholding that you're paying, but you're also getting rid of the withholding that you're paying for your private insurance, which, I pay quite a lot for that. So if my Medicare withholding went up, but I got rid of the amount that they're taking out to pay for my insurance, which is only partly paid by my employer, I'd probably come out ahead in the end and have a better healthcare system, healthcare payer.
Also, I just want to, you made a point about fraud. Many years ago, I actually worked as a side job for Medicare in terms of investigating fraudulent claims, and so I'd had some experience. But in order, just to go back to Joel's point, the administrative costs for commercial insurers are about 16 to 18%, 16 cents, 18 cents on a dollar spent by administrative costs, and about 6 cents is spent by Medicare. So would you have Medicare triple its administrative costs in order to catch a few more bad guys, in order to save $10 million? It would triple, do the numbers what 6% of 600 billion, what's that, 360 million, you triple that? It's pennies when you think about the fraud. I'm not supporting fraud. I'm just saying that the numbers, the economics don't work. And what happens when you layer in all of these other administrative burdens is that doctors start to refuse certain patients and certain payers. Patients themselves get deterred from getting care because they can't fill out the paperwork, they can't find the primary care doctor. So it's an argument I would stay away from. I mean, fraud is a bad thing, but the solutions can be worse.
As I'm sure all of you know, my beloved Congressman Bernie Sanders is a champion of a single payer. And I think it was a couple of years ago, we tried to single payer in Vermont. We like, as Vermonters, we like to try new ideas in our small, beautiful state. And I think I want to be very cautious. The idea was to reduce the administrative cost. But we have spent 2 or 3 years of studying a single payer in Vermont, and we came to the conclusion that we need to raise taxes both on workers, both employee and employer, and that wasn't really sustainable for even the state of Vermont. So we have to be very careful when we talk about this is a good policy and we can reduce the administrative cost. But we have to look at the total cost of the single payer, and we have to drop it. And I think, you know, some people really, I noticed, you know, the audience, I think most of you are very enthusiastic about the single payer. I might be very pessimistic, but I don't think this country is ready for a single payer. I don't think our politicians, they have the courage or to stomach, you know, to implement such a complicated, you know, idea, at least in my lifetime.
So we have time for one more question, and I have the question, and 30 seconds each, starting with Joel. Would each panelist tell us what, in their opinion, is the single most important change that should be made to the ACA, to the Affordable Care Act? Single most.
I think the biggest problem with the Affordable Care Act was the Supreme Court decision that allowed states to opt out of Medicaid expansion. It is why we have not achieved the coverage we would like. And what it's doing is exacerbating already pre-existing poverty and you know, social medical decline, horrible health outcomes in those states that were already worse, and now they're getting worse because of this. That decision isn't going to be overturned. But I think we have to convince people that live in those states with those bozo governors who basically said, here's all this federal money, we don't want it. We'll give it back to you. You can give it to the blue states. Make them even richer than they already are, and we'll just get poorer. If people in those states knew that that was what was happening, that they were giving away free federal money at their own expense, that they might someday get angry about it.
Yeah, well, I have no idea. I'm tempted to just crack a joke and say, change the name of the Trump Care and see what happens. But well, no, there is, you know, there was that. By the way, I'm actually not much impressed that the proposed approval is up over 50%. That's actually really very low for a big program like this, historically, looking at others. But there is that finding that when you pull Obamacare, people say, don't like it. But then you call it the Affordable Care Act, they like it a lot better. This is, you know, what call things is important. So I don't know. So I'm going to punt.
My answer to this is that it's a figure ground problem, that we're too focused on the figure of Affordable Care Act or Trump Care, and we've missed the plot here, that the background is that our principal drivers of our health have to do with our behaviors, our environment, and how we turn our genes on and off. So we're so narrowly focused, and all of this debate or some continued efforts to try to fix this, which needs to be done, have us at risk to lose the plot.
What I see two players. We have people who desperately need health care. And at the same time, we see insurance company that really need to make a decent, reasonable rate of return on their investment. They are not running a charity. And sometimes, even as economists, I agree, maybe they should not be in the business of maximizing their profit. But there is no company that is going to stay in business if they are not able to cover their costs. So what I'd like to do, what I'd like to see with Obamacare, is a transparency that the insurance company are not cooking the book. They open their book and say, look, it's going to cost us this much money during the year to survive, then I think I'm going to concentrate on the subsidy that, as a government, I'm going to give to the people to pay for their insurance. And then I really don't mind, you know, because this is a shared sacrifice, to increase the penalty or taxes on healthy, wealthy people, and said, I'm not pointing a gun at you, but as an individual, we have some responsibility to help one another. So I will increase tax or the penalty to make sure Obamacare survive and continue.
Thank you all for attending.